This is VOA News, coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. U.S. President Donald Trump has delivered his first commencement address at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, New York, where 1,100 U.S. Army cadets are graduating. In his remarks, Mr. Trump talked about the rich diversity in the class of 2020, but he also emphasized the theme of unity, perhaps ironic, at a time when many past defense establishment leaders have harshly criticized him as someone who promotes divisions. Case in point, former Trump Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who said the president has made no effort to unite the country. Trump has also gotten pushback from the current Pentagon chief, Mark Esper, who said he did not support the idea of using U.S. military troops to deal with racial justice protesters, something Mr. Trump had threatened to do. Another cloud, this week's admission from Military Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley, that he had made a mistake by appearing in a photo op with President Trump holding a Bible in front of a church. That was a short time after the street had been cleared of peaceful racial justice demonstrators. Milley said he had violated the principle of keeping the military out of politics. Donald Trump and defense officials are also at odds over the idea of renaming American bases, which honor the memory of Confederate military leaders. The Pentagon says it's open to the idea. The president says he won't even discuss it. The Confederacy was made up of southern states that left the Union in 1861. Then waged civil war against it until surrendering in 1865. The president says after talking to African-American friends, he has moved the date of a political rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, from June 19th to the 20th, out of respect for a date that celebrates the end of slavery in the United States. Mr. Trump has faced heavy criticism both for the timing and location of his rally. Tulsa was the scene of white mob killings that cost scores of American black lives during 2 days of violence in 1921. Some historians put the death toll as high as 300. This is VOA News. President Trump's decision to do the West Point address today in person countered a New York limit of 150 people because of the pandemic in the country. Cadets prepared for the day with 2 weeks in quarantine, and parents and friends were barred from the ceremony. New York has lost almost 31,000 lives to COVID-19, with a case count of close to 381,000. New York has lost almost 31,000 lives, with a case count of close to 381,000. COVID-19 continues to take thousands of lives a day. Johns Hopkins University puts the case count worldwide at almost 7.7 million, with nearly 427,000 lives lost. India's had about 309,000 cases in the world, with new cases up by 11,000 in the past day alone. India's fatality count is just under 9,000. Quoting unnamed sources, Politico is reporting that U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo plans a trip to Hawaii to meet with Chinese government officials. Pompeo is a strong China critic who has echoed President Trump's charge that China could have prevented the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people around the world by being more transparent about the coronavirus. Meanwhile, Beijing says it's locked down 11 residential neighborhoods to cope with a new outbreak of the disease. This after China said 45 people who live near a wholesale food market had tested positive for the virus. African leaders say China will ensure the supply of 30 million COVID testing kits and 10,000 ventilators a month to the African continent as the pandemic numbers there get worse. South Africa has well over a quarter of the continent's virus cases, with more than 61,000. The United States leads the world in COVID-19 numbers, more than 2 million cases and a death toll closing in on 115,000. There are new spikes in COVID figures reported in nearly 20 American states, including Texas, Arizona, Arkansas, and Alabama. But they are sticking with their back-to-work plans despite warning signs they risk the danger of expanding current outbreaks. Even with rising caseloads, eat-in restaurants in Texas are now being allowed to operate at 75% capacity. Arizona officials are warning people against being part of large crowds. President Trump takes his re-election campaign to Arizona 10 days from now in an arena that holds 6,500 people. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is warning people in Black Lives Matter demonstrations this weekend against violence, saying anyone attacking public property in the UK will face the full force of the law. At last weekend's London protests, there were dozens of arrests, with close to 30 police officers injured. Several demonstrations were planned for today. This is the first day that police in New York will operate under new measures signed into law by Governor Andrew Cuomo. This comes in response to the death of George Floyd, the black man who was killed while in police custody in Minneapolis. More news online at voanews.com. There is also a mobile app for your convenience. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, D.C.
Really be much more about planning and strategizing as we wait to meet with the management of the university. The COVID lockdown has to be lifted. Universities have to resume operations for me to go to the university.
A Ugandan High Court orders Makerere University to reinstate Dr. Stella Nyanzi, a critic of President Yoweri Museveni.
Certainly a long road left to travel, but I think we should not lose sight of the fact of the tremendous progress being made and the really courageous efforts being made on the ground to prioritize justice, but also social healing at the same time in a very potentially volatile political situation.
A member of the Junglers, a notorious security unit in the Gambia, faces charges in the U.S.
This ruling forces us to have a conversation in the country about the reform of the electoral system in ways that can make it a lot more accountable.
And a South African court declares an electoral act which prevents independent candidates from contesting in elections unconstitutional. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Dr. Stella Nyanzi, a Ugandan academic and an avowed critic of President Yoweri Museveni, says she's vindicated after a court ruling ordered her reinstatement by Makerere University. She says she plans to meet her attorney to decide the next steps forward Monday. Her remarks come after a high court ordered her reinstatement by Makerere University as a research fellow of the Makerere Institute of Social Research. They also want the university to pay $32,253 as compensation for the period of her suspension. The university suspended the academic for over 2 years for allegedly offending authorities of the school. Dr. Nyanzi tells me that she expects resistance from the university in the implementation of the court order. She also said that she and her attorney will come up with a strategy to ensure the university respects and implements the court's ruling.
I was very delighted to get the news of the court ruling, particularly because I've waited for so long for this particular piece of justice, right? Secondly, I was thrilled, pleasantly surprised that there are many, in a situation, in a context of repression, that there are still some judges, some judicial officers who stand for justice as opposed to looking for political favor from the dictator Museveni. And so I wasn't expecting this particular judge to be as lenient and understanding and just and fair in her trial, and it came as a pleasant surprise to me.
If I may ask you, the ruling mean for you?
The ruling for me is kind of bittersweet in many ways. I think it's very sweet and pleasant because I'm winning not just for myself, I'm winning for countless oppressed university staff whose contracts, whose employment, tenure at the university is abusive, it's oppressive, and their constitutional rights are violated on a day-to-day. I win for those individuals who cannot speak, who cannot contest oppressive employers. I think the victory is not mine alone, but it's for those of us who believe that all employees must be protected by the Constitution, by labor rights, and by the human rights provisions in the Constitution for all employees. I think that the win is an encouragement for many others who may be in my position, junior employees of universities, of the government, who choose to challenge seniors in well-established institutions of power, that we can still win. We can get our wins in court.
You feel vindicated?
In many ways, I do. I think that the bitterness, because I said it's a bittersweet sort of moment, because I realize that the victory in court does not necessarily translate into the university obeying the court orders. Mm-hmm. The university administration management were ordered to do what the tribunal ruled, not once but twice in previous rulings, where they were instructed to reinstate me, so give me back my job as research fellow, pay my unpaid salary, as well as my research grants that had been withheld, and sadly promote me. At the time when I protested, I was challenging an unduly long period of just waiting in suspension for a promotion that was supposed to happen at least in 2013 when I first applied for promotion.
Let me ask you this. Do you expect any possible pushback from the university in spite of the court ruling that asks for compensation, among other things?
Totally.
And how do you plan on dealing with it?
That is a bittersweet for me because it is a highly politicized position. My contract is now politicized. It is going to be very difficult for the university to reinstate me when the first lady, who is also Minister of Education, insisted that I should be fired. It's going to be very difficult for the university to pay me my dues, which have been unpaid for the last at least 2 years since when I was suspended, because the first lady, Minister of Education, insists I should not be paid because I offended her. And so even promotion, they would ask, why is she being promoted, yet she offended the first lady? And so I think I'm going to meet a lot of resistance from the university, but I'm also hoping, beyond hope, hoping against all odds, that Makerere University uses this moment to redeem itself and illustrate to the world that indeed it respects the rule of law and it obeys court orders. I don't plan to give up the struggle. I know that the day I open my office door and enter will be the real victory. The day that I see the money in my bank account will be the real victory.
I want to ask you, what are you going to do next week? Because it's Friday. Let's say it's Monday. Are you going to your office on Monday following this court rule? What's the next for you?
So on Monday, I'm going to meet with my lawyer and ask him, how does one then implement or actualize the court orders, given that we still have COVID-19? And so it's going to really be much more about planning and strategizing as we wait to meet with the management of the university. The COVID lockdown has to be lifted. Universities have to resume operations for me to go to the university.
Dr. Stella Nyanzi is a Ugandan academic and an avowed critic of President Yoweri Museveni. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. An Amnesty International researcher says the Tanzanian government sent mixed messages following the attack on Freeman Mbowe, chairman for the main opposition party, Chadema. The opposition leader is currently receiving treatment after the attack left him with a broken leg. Roland Iboli says the government should demonstrate a commitment to investigate and punish the perpetrators who carried out the attack. His comments come after opposition party supporters say the Speaker of Parliament and some senior members of the ruling party dismissed the seriousness of the attack. Some even alleged Mr. Mbowe is to blame for being too drunk to defend himself. The Tanzanian police say they are investigating the attack. Amnesty International researcher Roland Iboli tells me that the government should do more to find and punish those who carried out the attack to serve as a deterrent.
One of the things that we want to really express, without going into the politics of it, is whenever a senior politician like Freeman Mbowe, a chairman of the official opposition party, has complained that he was attacked and has been hospitalized, the government should really take that seriously, especially a few months to the general and presidential elections, which are happening in October. The last time such kind of an attack happened was, or in a similar way, was in 2017, where we saw Tundu Lissu, a fellow Chadema party official, attacked. And in that incident too, the government or officials of the government dismissed that incident. Yet it was a very serious incident whereby somebody's life was really in danger, and somebody had to, you know, to be flown to Nairobi and receive specialized treatment. So the government should really take this seriously, investigate it, and if at all there is anybody that was involved, they should be brought before the law.
Now, Roland, a regional commander has stated that they received the report of the attack and they are following it, investigating it, if you may. Is it not enough?
That is not enough. Why I'm actually saying it's not enough is because the government, one arm is saying, yes, they're investigating it, yet we have parliamentarians before parliament, including the speaker, who really dismissed this claim, saying that Freeman Mbowe might have been drunk and the attack is not what he says it was. But we are seeing here somebody that is hospitalized, somebody that, you know, has truly been assaulted, yet you have, government in various agencies dismissing it. And of course, to be politically correct, you have the regional commander who comes and says that, yes, we will investigate it. The government has to speak in one voice and condemn this attack, not just even say that they will investigate it. If at all it is not their position to actually attack, opposition members, then they should really make an official statement and condemn that kind of an attack.
Now, Roland, some supporters of the main opposition party, Chadema, are expressing doubt whether the government will attach any seriousness into investigating this yet another attack, as they said. You enumerated issues where Tunde Lucy was nearly assassinated. His supporters said corporate or perpetrators have yet to be brought to book. And this one on the chairman of Chadema, Freeman Mbowe. Do you think their doubt or their skepticism is justified?
Everybody can have their own opinion. And of course, with such kind of happenings in a country like Tanzania, of course, and at this time when you have a media that cannot really report on issues that they are, then we are likely to see or hear a lot of information coming to us from different sides, and a lot of skepticism as well, because remember, this attack happened just a day after Tundu Lissu announced his candidacy for presidency. Then this attack has also happened around a time when the government has proposed and passed various amendments to laws that are seen as repressive that passed yesterday. So you find there are also other people that might want to think that this attack truly happened, but it was to actually divert people from the real issues happening in the country around this time and the amendments to these laws. Specifically,
the supporters of the CCM have dismissed suggestions that leading up to the elections, there would be a surge in politically related violence, particularly targeting opposition leaders and supporters. What is the stance of Amnesty International regarding this concern?
We might not know what is in the government's agenda in as far as suppressing opposition itself. We do not know whether it is violence or it is any other form of suppression. But what we are sure already is there are laws that have been changed, such as the amendments that were done the other day and passed yesterday that prevent individuals from bringing up cases of constitutional violations if at all they are not directly affected by it. That is a direct indictment in terms of government trying to suppress avenues for citizens or Tanzanians to seek justice. Of course, there is already that amendment to prevent certain state of officials and including the president from being sued. Giving them immunity.
Roland Ibole is an Amnesty International researcher. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A member of the Junglers, a notorious security unit believed to have committed atrocities and human rights violations during former Gambian President Yahya Jammeh's rule, has been charged in the U.S. Local media say the Junglers are a select group of people from the Gambian army who only answer to the former president. The reports say members of the group operate like a private army outside the chain of command of the military. Michael Sankoria is charged for his role in the abuse of alleged coup plotters who failed in an attempt to overthrow the Jammeh government. Jeffrey Smith, is the founding director of Vanguard Africa, a non-profit organization that has worked extensively with the current Gambian government on human rights activities. He talks to me about the charges against Korea and what it means for justice as well as the future of the Gambia.
Yes, so Michael Song Correa was the man brought to book in Colorado, as you mentioned. He was a principal figure in Yahya Jammeh's Junglers Death Squad, essentially. The former president of Gambia had put together a private military operation of sorts to do his dirty work in the country. And as you know, and as your listeners are probably fully aware, under Jammeh's dictatorship for 22 years, it became known for the ruthless repression of political dissent, of independent journalism, of human rights activism. So Michael Correa, as part of this death squad, really was among the worst of the worst in the country, committing, quite honestly, the most heinous human rights abuses one could imagine. It would be as if you took the most villainous character from a Grimm's fairy tale and inserted him into real life. His crimes and his ruthlessness really knew no bounds. So I think this is really a big victory for justice and a big victory for Gambia and the victims who survived.
Now, Jeff, some in the Gambia are saying this is a big deal, but how unprecedented are these charges against Korea?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is really a momentous decision here in the U.S. As mentioned, Correa personally participated in the torture of numerous individuals, and it's actually not just suspected coup plotters. Oftentimes, Jammeh, as president of the Gambia, would use the pretext of an attempted coup to essentially purge his enemies and purge the security forces. But Correa specifically is implicated in the murder of many other people, including two Gambian American citizens, Alhaji Cisse and Ibao Job, leading newspaper editor Dada Haidara, journalist chief Ibrahim Amane, as well as an ex-intelligence chief, Daba Morena. So Correa was involved in a litany of abuses, of murders, and of torture over the course of several years. So these are very serious charges. I think the allegations are very strong. The evidence is there. And you know, I think Correa will very likely be facing justice.
So what does this mean to the people of the Gambia?
You know, it's crucially important because, as you might know, there's an ongoing truth, reconciliation, and reparations process, the TRCC, or the TRRC, ongoing in the Gambia today, an initiative being undertaken by the Justice Ministry and the Justice Minister, Bob Tambadou, and his colleagues. So really, this is another turning of the page in the Gambia. You know, Gambians, I think, writ large, having worked with activists and journalists there for a number of years, they're really looking to move the country forward, move beyond the dark Jammeh years, the dictatorship that abused their human rights and their dignity with impunity for over two decades. So I think this is an important development for justice and really, I think, an important component of the reconciliation and social cohesion process that is underway in the Gambia. So certainly very, very important on a number of different.
Now, Jeff, going back to the Gambia with respect to the TRRC, the reconciliation efforts being undertaken currently in the Gambia, some people are saying that the other members of the Junglers could go away scot-free because of this reconciliation efforts. Others are saying that the Junglers particularly should be singled out and punished just like Korea has been punished here in the U.S. What is your take and what are the circumstances on the ground, if I may ask you?
You know, I can honestly see both sides of the argument. It's a very contentious issue in the Gambia. Of course, you mentioned several other notable figures among the Junglers hit squad have been set free and are currently living free today because they came voluntarily and testified before the Truth, Reconciliation, and Reparations Commission. That does not mean that they will not ultimately face justice in the future. But I think it's a very fine thread that leaders in the Gambia are trying to navigate. You're trying to prioritize social healing and a cathartic sort of process after 2 decades of dictatorship. But at the same time, you know, justice is paramount, and they also want to hold the worst of the worst perpetrators accountable. At the same time, you know, at the broader macro political level, you have very heightened political tensions with a potentially volatile election coming up next year. Many Gambians feel as if the justice and reconciliation process is moving too slow and that there's a lack of political will at the highest level, including in the president's office. Again, we have to remember, too, that this is just 3 years removed from one of the worst dictatorships that the world had ever known, the Yahya Jammeh dictatorship. So the amount of progress that has been made is tremendous. There's certainly a long road left to travel, but I think we should not lose sight of the fact of the tremendous progress being made and the really courageous efforts being made on the ground to prioritize justice, but also social healing at the same time in a very potentially volatile political situation.
Jeffrey Smith is the founding director of Vanguard Africa, a nonprofit organization that has worked extensively with the current Gambian government on human rights activities. He spoke with me from here in the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C. Amid the coronavirus pandemic's disruptions, a Zimbabwean farmer is defying the odds and growing flowers and other horticultural products which he is exporting to Europe. For VOA, Kutsanai Muzenge brings us more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
From a distance, the lush green plants on the fields by the main entrance to Lingfield Farm could be a number of crops. But at close range, one can see there are flowers. Lingfield Farm, about 20 kilometers east of Gweru City's central business district, is owned by the Karimazondo family. 39-year-old Tatenda Karimazondo is the farm's operations director. His parents, now elderly and semi-retired, used to grow flowers for export in the 90s until the industry fell apart following the country's controversial land reform program. A chartered accountant by training, Karimazondo decided there was still money to be made from growing flowers and revived the enterprise nearly 4 years ago.
I started doing research to find out, no, look, my parents used to do this long back when they were white agents. What about if I source the markets myself in Europe? Can I not resuscitate it and export directly? And that is what has motivated me until where we're at right now.
Farm manager Jason Majira says there are 5 varieties of summer flowers grown in line with the requirements of the market in the Netherlands. The growers have to liaise with the market at every stage. The planting season begins in July for the first batch of flowers for the start of the selling season in October. The final batch of summer flowers is sold at the end of June.
We do summer flowers and we also do proteas, which last for almost 15 to 20 years in the ground. Summer flowers we plant according to the program given by the market in Europe. We agree maybe 3 months before time so that we plan. We plant in batches because if we plant in one go, when they ripe, we will not manage to harvest them all. When we plant in batches, we calculate the number of stems needed by the customers.
Lingfield Farm exports an average of 2 tons of flowers every week. They are ferried by a customized lorry to the international airport in Harare, then airlifted to the Netherlands. The farm makes an annual turnover of $500,000. Majgira says when the coronavirus pandemic broke out, they were left counting their losses as shipments were halted for over 6 weeks.
We were affected a lot with this coronavirus because when it started, the markets closed. We're just harvesting the flowers and throwing away because there were nowhere to send them. So we affected a lot because I think we did almost 2 months throwing away the flowers.
Karimazondo is not deterred by such challenges. As in any other pursuit, he believes commitment is the key to success. Because they have a niche market, he believes he can always profit from growing flowers.
You have to have passion for whatever you do so that you are able to come through in the long run. If you don't have passion, then you give up before the goal has been won. So farming is about passion. You have to have the passion to keep on going.
Lingfield Farm also produces green beans and peas for export to Britain and Germany, along with crops for the local market and dairy and beef cattle. Karima Zondo is increasing the hectareage of the flowers as well as the beans and peas in the coming season. But he bemoans Zimbabwe's persistent cash shortages, which he says affect his operations, especially when it comes to paying his 500 workers. Karima Zondo also criticizes what he describes as inconsistent policies by government, including the fact that exporters are not allowed to directly access the foreign currency that they earn. The flower industry was one of the country's top foreign currency earners, and it ranked second only to Kenya in export sales. Now it's blossoming again. Reporting from Gweru for VOA English to Africa, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Nigeria celebrated Democracy Day Friday, June 12th. The day marked 21 years of uninterrupted civilian rule since the country returned to constitutional rule in 1999. A series of activities were carried out throughout the day to celebrate the longest stretch of civilian rule without a military intervention. Some Nigerians say the current democratic dispensation has not been beneficial. Critics accuse subsequent government and the current leadership and their close allies of amassing wealth, plunging a significant portion of the population into poverty. Others, however, say the country has made significant strides after embracing the tenet of democracy. They cite smooth transfers of power from one democratically elected leader to the next as worthy of praise. Femi Falana, a prominent human rights lawyer, tells me that it is clear that Nigeria has enjoyed 21 years of uninterrupted frustration.
It's been 21 years of uninterrupted frustration and disenchantment for the majority of our people. While members of the ruling class have, of course, been smiling to the bank at the expense of our people. So the opportunities that could have been taken advantage of by the government to fix the major problems confronting the country have been missed. We have blackout most of the time, energy crisis, crisis in the energy sector, blackout during the day and at night, insecurity of life and property, kidnapping.
Now, Mr. Falana, do you think the past 21 years, leaders that Nigerians have had, democratically speaking, have they met the expectations and aspirations of the people?
We haven't had democracy for 21 years. We have had civil rule anchored on impunity. Law has been abeyance. Human rights are violated on a very regular basis. The rule of law is trampled upon. And people are wondering why Nigerians have not trooped to the street to demonstrate against the killing in America. And we've tried to mobilize people. And what we are told is that even in enforcing the lockdown regulations in Nigeria, over 30 Nigerians have been killed by the Nigerian police and the other armed agencies of the state. So the immediacy of the crisis in America is lost on our people. People are still detained illegally for months and years. So there's no way you can celebrate democracy. So what we have had in 21 years is at best civil rule as opposed to military rule. But in terms of respect for the rights of our people.
There's a suggestion in Nigeria that the worst of democracy is better than the best of military rule in the Nigerian context. What is your take?
I don't agree with that. It's a stupid statement in the sense that UAE, for instance, UAE is ruled by emirs who are not elected by anybody. Therefore, there's no way you can say that any civilian government in Burkina Faso, for instance, has been better than the regime of Thomas Sankara for 4 years, 1983 to 1987. So that the Sankara era in Burkina Faso has become a reference point if you're talking of development in that country. And it also for the entire African continent. So it's not totally correct to say the best of military rule is better than the worst of civilian democracy. Or dictatorship is, whether of the military or civilian wing, disobedience to the rule of law is the same, whether perpetrated by civilians or military rulers. So that there is no historical basis for that statement. It's fallacious.
So, Mr. Falana, let me ask you, what do you expect in Nigeria's democracy going forward? If you say Nigeria has not been experiencing democracy by civilian rule, what are your expectations for the next coming years?
The challenges before the Nigerian people is to take advantage of the contradiction in the system, further compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic, to reorganize the country in a way that every vote will matter, because the constitution provides for popular participatory democracy. That is not the case now. Our democracy has been hijacked by buccaneers and money bags. So unless you transfer power to the people, you can't talk of democracy. Secondly, so unless you take control of the economy and ensure that our people are productively engaged in a way that there will be economic prosperity in the country, you can't talk of democracy in the air. The challenge before us is for the new progressive forces to mobilize the masses of our people to take control, you know, of their political destiny. That is the only way you can enjoy democracy in Nigeria or in any African country.
So, Femi, before we go, there have been increasing concern that some Nigerians are rather saying that it is better for the country to be in a military rule rather than what they are experiencing now, because things seem not to be working for them in this civilian rule that you described. What is your take on that?
No, those who say that are talking aren't nuts, and they have short memory, that they have quickly forgotten what this country went through under all manners of military dictators. That was the period our country made huge revenue from the sale of oil. Yet, the military dictators, unlike what you had in Latin America and Asia, they couldn't use their dictatorial power to fix any of the problems confronting the country. Therefore, we cannot go back to that era, that inglorious era, the era of underdevelopment of our country. Therefore, the political atmosphere of civil rule or pseudo-democracy provides an opportunity for Nigeria to expand the democratic space, to empower our people and ensure that the rule of law is observed, human rights are respected, and people are economically empowered. That is the only way our country can move. We can't go back to the era of military dictatorship. That era is gone.
Femi Falana is a prominent Nigerian human rights lawyer. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Lagos. A South African court has declared as unconstitutional an electoral act which prevents independent candidates from contesting in elections. Under the Constitutional Court ruling, only members of political parties can contest in polls across the country. Many South Africans say the measure gives enormous powers to the political parties. They also say it prevents individuals from having the power to choose to belong to a party or to seek political office. Analysts say the Constitutional Court ruling could have a significant impact on the three major political parties. They include the governing African National Congress, ANC, the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA Party, and the Economic Freedom Party, EFF, led by Julius Malema. To learn more about the significance of the court ruling and the possible impact it could have on political parties and individuals seeking office in future elections, I reach Ongama Ntika, a political science professor at Nelson Mandela University in Port Elizabeth, South Africa.
This is a good step in the right direction. South Africa currently uses a system that is hybrid at a local government level, in terms of which specific residential areas can vote for independent candidates when they are displeased with the political parties. And it has happened before where you find that an independent candidate who had previously served as a councillor of a particular political party, that once they run independently in an election, they're able to even win the seat at the municipal council back. and beating the candidates of political parties. What that means is that there are times when South Africans, I see more value in an individual leader than in the political party. And as political parties in South Africa have lost a huge degree of support over time since 1999.
Ogama, let me ask you, additionally, what impact do you think this ruling, or do you anticipate this ruling on having on these three major political parties, the ruling African National Congress and the two main opposition parties, talking about the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters?
Depending on what the threshold is that will be required to secure a seat in a provincial legislature or national parliament. These individuals can challenge both the Democratic Alliance and the ANC. Both of those parties are facing huge legitimacy crisis. And if politicians that are perceived to have been removed wrongly in those political parties go ahead and run independently, chances are that sometimes they can have great success, as we see in the local government system.
Now, Ongama, the little known party or the minor political party, the New Nation Movement, which took the case to court to challenge the Electoral Act, that it infringes a person's right to make individual political choices. Do you think the party has been vindicated by this ruling?
If you look at it, it's small parties that were affected by this, and they already operate as single seat parties in parliament, where you find that a leader of these small parties actually gets to be the only member of that party that sits in the National Assembly. What this does is, the availability of the option to contest as an individual can help save these members from the costs of political party building, which they needed to do in order for them to be accepted as candidates, whereas they had no intentions whatsoever of building sustainable parties. So this option now allows these candidates to actually not pretend to be building parties, when in fact all that they want is to be able to have their voices heard in the National Assembly or provincial legislature.
Ogama, what do you say to some analysts who are of the view that the big political parties, or the three major political parties, will not be happy with this ruling because this will in some way undermine their authority and their dominance in South African politics? What is your take?
I don't think this will have a huge systemic effect as far as the ability of political parties to stamp their authority among their members. What it does, though, is it actually starts weakening the grip, only in a small way. And I hope that it opens up a discussion among South Africans around constituency-based representation rather than proportional representation, which is based on closed party list. I think the debate has been simmering here that says perhaps there's value in adopting what is happening in the U.S. as well as what we have at a local government level of having constituencies directly elect representatives who then become more accountable to them than their parties, than the approach of proportional representation on a closed party list, which gives the party a lot more power and therefore its deployees in parliament or legislative houses a lot more burden toward the party line. So the hope here is that this ruling forces us to have a conversation in the country about the reform of the electoral system in ways that can make it a lot more accountable.
Ongama Mtika is a political science professor at the Nelson Mandela University in Port Elizabeth. He spoke with me from Port Elizabeth, South Africa. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing for $186 million to protect and assist hundreds of thousands of civilians who have been forced to flee from escalating increasingly brutal attacks from multiple armed groups in the volatile Central Sahel region. For the UAE, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Conditions for civilians in the Sahel are becoming increasingly dire and threatening as armed groups attack them with deliberate ferocity. The UN Refugee Agency reports attacks by Islamist extremists and criminal gangs in Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso have crippled life in the border towns and areas and forced people to flee their homes multiple times. The agency reports more than 3 million, including 831,000 refugees, are displaced in the region, making the Sahel one of the fastest-growing displacement crises in the world. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balich tells VOA the continuing indiscriminate attacks on innocent civilians are unfathomable.
These horrible accounts or incidents include summary executions, the widespread use of rape against women, and attacks against state institutions, including public infrastructure like schools and health facilities. This is a very troubling and a tragic trend that we have seen unfolding in the Sahel region. It's very difficult to understand it.
Bullard says displaced families live in overcrowded sites where access to basic services is minimal. He says many people arrive in impoverished communities without any belongings. He says they are welcomed by local people who themselves live hand to mouth. In addition, he says escalating insecurity is hampering the delivery of humanitarian aid. Ballard says money from the appeal is a critical lifeline for all these people on the run and for the communities hosting them.
If we don't get enough support, the consequences on the ground for these people in terms of basic needs, food, water, shelter, would be disastrous. But also the added element of COVID makes it more important to bring all the relief to the desert areas.
Balich says 3.1 million people in Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Niger, and Mauritania are in desperate need of humanitarian support. For them, he says, international aid is a matter of life and death. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Africa, in a gun you can eat a baby. Shauru taki kabisa, etu na chena visa, ya fira mina musrigi. Iki lala na utakama, nani ita, nafumba machu, nafuta shuka, naona na pumba zika, unishika, kondipo hapo, nafarigika. Mambo yako, mahaba yako, no mana na tono no kawe. Wana, pale tulipo kutana, mikono tukapeana, macho ya kati zamana. Wana, pale tulipo kutana, na bakubadilishana, nafsi kukubaliana. Kapona rapi ameni banu sura jeuri sina tena wendo kiganzi meni maliza hasira siku mwe kisema nidekeze nilewaze washushuke wanyamaze nikinunga nibembeleze usini pepe nipulize ume washituke roza uzi waume mini pike ule chote. Shiniringe ni wako.
nitambulishe nitambe ni wavimbie.
She's so insecure, she don't make love with the lights on. So insecure, she don't wanna talk about it, no. And I'm so insecure, one day she leaves me and she find another guy who make her happier than I. I'm so insecure, I'm never telling you about it. Yeah. Who and I swim on a t-shirt, and you never leave your house with no makeup on. But let's not talk about it. And burn, hope we see the light.
You're insecure. I'm insecure. passion. So I go do anything for your love.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot quench your thirst with pepper. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington.
Good evening, Africa.